Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. And we are here with one of the more important folks in musical theater right now. He, at one point, had three different musicals running on Broadway at the same time. And I'm not sure if that's the only time that's happened, but it is quite rare. His name is Frank Wildhorn, and one of the nice things about what he does in musicals is that he blends the traditions of musical theater from the Frank Lessers and the Rodgers and Hammersteins with pop music and sometimes a country sensibility that he came from as well. So lots of stuff to talk about, and he's also working on bunches of stuff. Please welcome to the neighborhood Frank Wildhorn. Hey, Frank.
Hello, David. How you doing?
I am great. And one of the things I wanted to say that, you know, I've interviewed you before, and you seem, and this is really neat, kind of approachable and nice. And I know that's a schmoozy kiss-butt question, but at the same time, has that helped you, do you think, in your career?
Yeah. You know, listen, if I am nothing else, I always feel I am the audience. You know, I've always felt myself as kind of a blue-collar songwriter anyway. As a self-taught musician growing up in New York and then Florida and, you know, being in all the different bands that I've been, I feel that if nothing else, I've been pretty good in being in touch with the people that actually work and pay for their tickets to go to the theater. And I think that's helped me along the way. It certainly has helped me in the record business where, you know, the word popular means you're selling, you know, to the populace. And that's a good word, and that's a thing we try to do. So keeping my finger on the pulse and trying to consider myself just one of the audience, I think, has always helped me.
Well, in that sense, why don't we go right back to the beginning where you got your start in music? Because it wasn't like you went to a musical theater workshop or Lehman Engel or anything like that. It was in the pop field.
Yeah, well, you know, the truth of the matter is I'm a self-taught piano player and composer. I started when I was a teenager down in Florida. And I was actually working as a lifeguard for the city of Fort Lauderdale and playing football in high school. And I became a musician because I thought it was a good way to meet girls.
Was it?
Like that. And it was, yeah. Well, along with being the lifeguard and the football player.
Yeah, that's true.
But the truth is that it so soon thereafter, the music really took over my life. And in fact, I remember very distinctly turning to my folks when I was like 16 and saying, listen, guys, it doesn't matter anymore. It's the music, and wherever it takes me, that's where my life is going to be. And thank God, you know, we've always kind of just stayed that course, and the music has been so good to me, so I try to be good to it. And it really started there. And then I went to USC, University of Southern California, and I was a history student, but the drama program there, who was at that time run by a man named Rick Toskin, and artistically by the old English actor you probably know, John Houseman.
Oh, my gosh.
And he really started a wonderful, very strange relationship with me. In that,
John Houseman?
Yeah, and that he loved my spirit and loved where I was coming from, so he would produce all my shows there. You know, and it was a wonderful thing, and I got just so many rare opportunities, especially not being a theater or music student and coming from history, and that's where it started. And what happened was, David, is that at that time, the late 70s, early 80s, the music publishing business was really in Los Angeles. That was a time where it was centered there. And all the music publishers used to come to see my shows at SC. And they would all say, well, why are you wasting your time in theater? You're not going to make any money in theater. You're just going to get your heart broken. You have a pop sensibility. Come write, you know, for us.
Right.
And I got my first pop publishing, you know, deal. And, you know, also I had gotten married very young at that time and had a kid very young, and there were bills to pay and dogs to feed and valves to feed. And so I signed these pop publishing deals, and literally for the decade of the 80s was about 450 records, pop records, which I guess culminated with Whitney Houston's Where Do Broken Hearts Go. That record sold about 23 million copies around the world and was number one in 43 countries. And so by the time that had happened, I had kind of bought myself the freedom, the time, really, is what I'm talking about, to go back to my love of theater and then explore that in the way I wanted to explore that. And so that's kind of when everything, you know, my life changed and I became more New York than Los Angeles. And that's really the 90s up to now, the last, you know, certainly 14, 15 years between Victor Victoria, Jekyll and Hyde, Civil War, The Scarlet Pimpernel, Dracula, etc., has really taken up much of my life, though I've never left the pop world, and that's why for the last 10 years I've run a division of Atlantic Records, which I created Atlantic Theater. So I've always kind of been both in the theater world and in the pop world, and until my kids tell me I'm not hip anymore, I'm going to try to keep them both.
We'll be right back with Frank Wildhorn in just one moment. We're back with Frank Wildhorn, and we're going to talk now about the theater, because you mentioned that it was your first love, in a sense. So tell me about the shows that you saw and the people that most influenced you to be a musical theater person.
Well, here's the interesting thing. It really wasn't the theater that got me interested in theater. I was at the time I was teaching myself to play the piano. There was a weekend, I remember, that I had the flu or something like that, and I was hung up in bed for the weekend. And I remember watching the movie versions back-to-back in Florida of Jesus Christ Superstar and West Side Story.
Okay.
Okay? And in the movie versions of those two shows, which of course I knew had come from theater, but I had seen neither one of them, you could hear the musical vocabularies of so many different and varied kinds of music. You know, from jazz to rock, from classical to Latin, from kind of traditional musical theater to, you know, something we've never heard before. The freshness of Bernstein's score, which is, you know, obviously still today, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest score. And then, you know, in Weber's score of Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, you really heard, especially at that time, a rock and roll sound and a pop music sound that was incorporated not only in the writing but in the orchestrations of the movie. In fact, you know, in that movie, ironically, you know, the guy who played Judas was Carl Anderson, and Carl passed away this last year of leukemia. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't.
Great, great singer. But the story is that years later, Carl and I met, became best of friends. He recorded for me on the Civil War album. He opened the Goodwill Games for me in 1998 when I wrote all the music for the Goodwill Games. And we became great friends. But when I was a kid, you know, at 14 or 15, watching those two movies back to back, I said to myself, listen, I'm never going to sing, because if you heard me sing, you would know what I mean by that. So I wasn't going to be Billy Joel or Elton John or anything like that.
Right.
And even then, I kind of knew that writing just pop songs, meaning just trying to get songs to artists to record, wasn't going to be enough. And the fact that the theater gave me a place to stretch my creative muscles in a way that only the theater can is really what, you know, started this romance between the theater, with the theater.
Do you remember the first song that you wrote for a show? I mean, what surprised me is you mentioned Victor Victoria, which thought was a Leslie Bricus piece, wasn't it?
Leslie Bricus and Henry Mancini, but right. Mr. Mancini passed away during the process of the show. And Leslie and I, of course, were collaborators on Jekyll and Hyde, working our way to Broadway.
Right.
And Julie Andrews heard the score of Jekyll and Hyde, and she heard an early album that I had written and produced for Linda Etter, and she really loved it. And so she asked Leslie to call me, and I came in and wrote 3-4 songs for Victor Victoria, including Living in the Shadows, the 11 o'clock song for the show.
Cool. And you were hooked at that point. That was it.
So I was already hooked. I tell you, the hook came in 1990 when we did Jekyll and Hyde at the Alley Theater in Houston, Texas. The Alley Theater is one of the country's great regional theaters, and it's run by one of my best friends, a man named Gregory Boyd. And in 1990, he produced and directed what is to this day, still some people will tell you, the quintessential version of Jekyll and Hyde. Mm-hmm. And certainly gave birth to what Jekyll and Hyde became and is around the world today.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, let's talk about Jekyll and Hyde, because that was your real calling card for musical theater. And
no question. And in fact, if it wasn't for Jekyll and Hyde and the experience of doing Jekyll and Hyde and having such a great experience, I probably, David, to tell you the truth, would have stayed in the pop world much longer, because certainly I was financially being rewarded much more writing for Whitney Houston than you do in the theater. But it was such a great experience, and Greg gave me such artistic freedom to really grow, and either the way he handled me and the way it was Linda's first musical experience, it was my musical team's first experience in the theater. It was just such a great experience that it got us all hooked.
Well, let me ask about Jekyll and Hyde, because people were a bit surprised by the path it took. You did a lot of things kind of differently with that musical than people did with Broadway-bound shows at that time. And in some ways, I think that worked very much to your advantage. And in other ways, maybe it cost you something. But can you explain its trip to Broadway?
Yeah, and it's a good point that you do bring up. It is always a double-edged sword when you try to do something, you know, that's kind of not being done at the time. And, you know, what I tried to do was I felt confident that we had some real accessible melodies and accessible songs in Jekyll and Hyde. And, you know, they always say it's nice to come out of the theater humming the tunes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's better when the audience comes in humming the tunes.
Right.
And I, you know, fortunately, because of my relationships with the record companies and the record industry, I got a lot of support to record this music before there was a show. And so in 1989-90, in London, with London Philharmonic and Linda and Colm Wilkinson, who at that time was Jean Valjean in Les Mis, we recorded the first of the Jekyll and Hyde concept records. Then in 1995, when the pre-Broadway tour was happening, don't forget, Jekyll was one of the only shows to have a full year on the road before Broadway.
Exactly. Yeah. I was also talking about that whole sort of all the success you had before getting to New York, as opposed to like one tryout in Chicago and then boom, you open. You really, you know, you walk that thing around the whole country.
Well, again, you know, there was a different mentality going into the producing of the show, and the producers themselves saw the success that the music was having out there, the fact that this is the moment and a new life and someone like you were being recorded by the Moody Blues and Johnny Mathis and Styx and you know, Clinton's inaugural Jennifer Holliday sang This Is the Moment, etc., and Miss America was singing A New Life, and all of that was going on. And so we tried to take advantage of that and get the, listen, again, it goes back to my original philosophy, you know, get the show to the people, let the people decide. And so in 1995, we did a second concept record of Jekyll and Hyde, this time a double record. And this was with Anthony Warlow, the great Anthony Warlow from Australia, with Linda Carolee Carmello, Brenda Russell from the R&B world, who's now writing I See Color Purple, John Raitt. It was just a wonderful combination of people we had. And that record, that record really became the blueprint for what the show became and is today around the world, and I think now, you know, 40 productions around the world.
But let's then talk specifically about Broadway, because Jekyll and Hyde ran, I think, about a year and a half, which is a nice run.
No, on Broadway?
Yeah, didn't it run? It ran a long time.
4.5 years.
It ran 4.5. I'm sorry. Ooh, I mean, I'm not sorry, but congrats.
Over 1,500 shows.
And yet, was it, quote unquote, a commercial hit? I don't know if it was always like on that borderline.
It's an interesting thing, because it's an interesting conversation. This past year, with the productions around the world, the tours that we've had, I believe Jekyll has now grossed over $500 million. That's with a B. And on Broadway, I believe when we closed, it was something like $126 million that we had grossed. You know, I am not an expert on the financial doings of Broadway and where the money goes and all of that kind of stuff. But I have certainly never talked to an investor that was not happy with Jekyll and Hyde.
Oh, no, I wasn't trying to get at that. I'm trying to see how Broadway economics are
a whole other conversation, Dave.
Yeah.
People who know that stuff much better than I, it's a strange, interesting world.
Some of your other shows didn't do quite that well on Broadway, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about something else that you did that sort of shocked the
theater
world involving the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Yeah, well, Scarlet Pimpernel had its own interesting life, and we actually had 2.5 years out of Scarlet Pimpernel on Broadway. Maybe it was three. I know it was about 900 performances of Scarlet Pimpernel. The thing about Scarlet Pimpernel was we opened it at the Minskoff Theater, and we did not get good notices. But we saw, and the producers saw, how much the audiences loved the show. a couple of people who were in the audience loved the show so much that they actually bought out the original and bought the show, hired a new director, and while we were running one show, we were rehearsing another show, which is now fondly called Scarlet Pimpernel 2.0.
Right, exactly.
And that version of the show was the one that actually was reviewed well, even by Mr. Brantley in the Times, I must say, my one good review from the Times.
I saw two of the versions. I think I saw one.
Right.
And in fact, it's kind of a funny story, and this is amazing that I'm getting to tell you this, but that was the night that I proposed to my wife. We had gone to the theater. We went to the theater. We had this wonderful time, but we were also kind of scared because this was version 1.0, and it ran about 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Right.
And we wanted to get engaged that day because I think the 18th or some date connected to when we met. And
right.
We had to get back to, like, her apartment in Forest Hills between the time from getting out of the show, seeing the show, and also we hadn't eaten dinner. So we, you know, quickly ran to grab some, like, fried chicken on the train, and we're able to bam in the door like a quarter to midnight so that I could get the ring on her finger.
Oh, how great.
So romantic in a weird way.
Yeah, that's great. You know, it's funny. My little boy, Jake, he takes karate, and the guy who teaches him karate one day pulled me aside and said, Mr. Welton, I just thought I would show you something. And he took off his wedding ring, and inside the wedding ring was inscribed, "You are my home." And that, of course, is the song from the Scarlet Pimpernel that they do.
So, but you even...
I took my girlfriend, who was then my girlfriend, and when we became married, we inscribed our rings with "You Are My Home."
See, everybody has, like, that little sweet story.
I love it. Listen, that's what it's all about, David.
I mean, well, you don't see it much with Sweeney Todd. I mean...
No, you probably
don't. Say something, "You Are My Meat Pie." But you, even after 2.0 of Scarlet Pimpernel, there was a 3.
Well, the reason why, and again, this is, you're talking about the machinations of Broadway. Evidently, the Niederlanders, who had the Minskoff Theater, had already made a deal with Robert Stigwood to bring Saturday Night Fever into the Minskoff. And I guess they didn't think we were going to run as long as we did, or whatever the story was.
Mm-hmm.
So one day we got a call that, guys, we have to move. What do you mean we have to move? And yes, we have to move. So we moved to the Neil Simon. And we then had 3.0 and a new cast at the Neil Simon. And then we had almost 3 years of touring, which was great for around the country.
Sure.
And now, you know, Scarlet Pimpernel is in Germany today. It's in Finland. It's in Australia. It's in Canada, etc. But that hurt it very much on Broadway because, David, imagine having a restaurant and you build a restaurant and the clientele. And as you know, it's so much about word of mouth and the buzz and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And then you finally get going, and your numbers are great, and you're making your nut, and all that kind of stuff. And then you have to move.
It's like starting from zero, or from 10.
And you know how hard that is. And I think that was a very tough thing in the case of Scarlet Pimpernel. Well, because if we would have stayed in the Minskoff, or more so, if you ask me personally, I would tell you if we would have started in a little smaller, intimate theater, as opposed to the Minskoff, I think we would have run, you know, probably as long as Jekyll and Hyde, or even longer. And certainly, you know, Douglas Sills had become a star from Scarlet Pimpernel, and was great box office.
Yeah, and he was really good. And I have to say, you know, I liked the first version. I had some problems with it, but it was also improved when, and I think I saw 3.0 after it moved. So, I mean, you did find things to change and shorten, and it was cuter and more fun.
Yeah, but again, it goes back to the nature of theater, which is, you know, theater is a living thing, and I don't really believe in doing cookie-cut-out versions of my own shows. In fact, one of the other, I think you would probably call unusual things I do is, for instance, in Jekyll and Hyde now, there's been over 40 international productions. In fact, in December, I'm going to Tokyo to celebrate the 4th year in Tokyo. And it's been recorded, I believe, in now 9 languages, 12 or 13 times.
Wow.
And Leslie Brickus and I give each production and each producer and each director, we give them the tools, we give them the songs we've written, the scripts, et cetera, but we really let everybody do their own production. So each production around the world is very different, as opposed to if you saw Les Mis or Phantom or most shows, you know, you're going to see that show in that language. We really have given people the freedom to do completely new productions with new visions. And you know what? I love that. I love that. It keeps it alive. It keeps it different. And I don't want to pretend to know more about somebody's audience in Norway than the Norwegians do. So I really let them do their thing. In Germany, for instance, you know, they've always told us, listen, we're used to Wagner. We can sit longer. So we want more of the songs that you cut out of Broadway. So we put them back in. And I like that. I like being able to do that.
I think that's pretty cool. I mean, I think there are times, and let me know about this, because you mentioned Ben Brantley, who is the head theater critic of the New York Times, and he slammed, like, the first Pimpernel, and then as you said, kind of liked the later ones. But do you think that on some level you don't get a fair shake from the New York critics, like Dracula, which I thought was quite entertaining?
Well, you know what? I'm really not the one to ask. I mean, you know, the producers who keep, thank God, you know, financing and supporting my stuff would probably say, you know, what you're saying, that, you know, maybe I'm not getting that kind of respect or stuff like that because of my background, where I come from, the fact that I don't make any bones, that I am trying to write for the people, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't know what the reason is, but you know, that's not, it's almost a conversation with others about it, as opposed to with me myself, because that, if you know me, David, if you knew my personality and my disposition, that's not what I'm about. I'm a musician and I'm a composer more than I am, you know, I'm a man of the theater or a man of this or a man of that. I mean, I work in whatever genre that I'm working in, and I love them all, and I try to do my best in all of them. But music has been so good to me, and it's already made so many of my dreams and my family's dreams and my kids' dreams come true in a way I never, ever would have imagined when I started. But, you know, you just dream about. And so all that other stuff, you know, and the vanguards of theater who like to tell the world what theater is and what's good and what's not, et cetera, like that, I don't have a lot of time for that. I'm too busy making it, if you know what I mean.
Cool. Yeah, no, I mean, like,
I've always felt like I'm in the business and in the world to make things, not to comment on them, but to actually do something and make them.
Oh, no, but I'm saying, like, something, like, there's a lovely song in Pimpernel called Storybook Ending. And I've always sort of struck me that if Jerry Herman had written it,
right,
they would can say, oh, that's one of the cool, really, you know, wonderful Jerry Herman songs. But because you wrote it, it was a Pimpernel, it's kind of, you know.
You're not the first to tell me that, and I appreciate that very much. And I wish, listen, this is, you know, obviously I wish that sometimes they weren't so tough on me, but what am I going to do? You know what? I can't change my life. I'm not going to change what I do or how I do it, so. Hi, this is Frank Wildhorn, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By. Enjoy.
So from the past, we go into the future. Now, a couple of years ago, the next project that was supposed to be coming down the pike was something called Havana. Where's that at?
Havana is being written. It's an original show. It's not based on a movie or a book.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, it's hard enough to get it right when it is based on a movie.
Yeah.
So Havana has really gone through a lot of changes and stuff, and it's one of those projects in the hopper that consistently is worked on. The songs from Havana are out there. Linda recorded Havana This Time Around, Why Do People Fall in Love? And you know, they've been great, you know, to have those songs out there. And I think it'll get there.
Okay. And but if that's not the first one on the hopper, then what are some of the things that are on the hopper at the moment?
Well, this is good. You're gonna think I'm nuts, but I'm about to go into the busiest 18 months of my entire career right now.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. First of all, I've just started a record company with my friend Jeremy Roberts, who's been Linda's musical director for 20 years and kind of the original arranger for Jekyll and Hyde, and has kind of been my musical alter ego on Civil War, Scarlet Pimpernel, most of my shows.
Mm-hmm.
We started a record company called Global Vision, and we are in the middle of negotiating our distribution deal with a major label right now. And we're going to have distribution, you know, around the world for all our products, which is we're very excited about.
Well, didn't you say that you were already heading like a division of Atlantic? Why not just, what would make you start a label instead of just doing something at Atlantic?
Because last year, Atlantic, which is part of Time Warner,
mm-hmm,
Time Warner sold their entire music division.
Uh-huh.
Time Warner is no longer in the music business. They sold Warner Brother Records, Elektra Records, Atlantic Records. They sold their publishing company, which is all Gershwin, Porter, all that kind of stuff. They sold it all to Edgar Bronfman.
Oh,
I believe
okay.
is the guy from Seagram's.
Seagram's, yeah.
Seagram's. And what he's doing with it, I don't know. But that ended my kind of relationship there.
Okay.
It was a great, great 10-year run and, you know, so many wonderful projects that we were able to do there. But the world has changed. And he now owns it. It is no longer Warner Brothers or Atlantic, you know, under Time Warner. It is whatever it is now. And so that ended. So Jeremy and I decided to do this thing, and because I have now completed the Dracula concept recording, because I'm in the studio right now doing a Jekyll and Hyde in concert recording, which is part of a new business we can talk about.
Yeah.
And I'm also about to start next week the precast concept recording of Cyrano.
Oh.
Cyrano is Leslie Bricus and I again after Jekyll and Hyde. It is produced by the great English producer Bill Kenwright.
Mm-hmm.
It will open in England either spring or fall of 2006, depending on theater availabilities.
Sure.
And if we were having this conversation a few weeks from now, I could tell you everybody who's on the record, but I can't.
Sure, no problem. No problem.
But the people will be very excited when they hear about who is on this record and who's playing what.
And it does sound like your kind of material, the kind of things that Cyrano seems sort of right for what you do.
Well, it's bigger than life.
Right.
It's a passion of Leslie's since 1958.
Wow.
When an old girlfriend of him bought him an old rare copy of Cyrano and inscribed it with, "One day you will write a musical of this." So that's how long it's been in Leslie's life.
Wow.
And it just felt right as something for Leslie and I to do after Jekyll. We've had a ball doing it. We did great demos of it. And Bill Kenwright's going to produce it. So that's part of the agenda of 206.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also part of the agenda of Global Vision Records. But in 206, just to give you some scoops here, the Civil War is going to open June 206. At the Majestic Theater at Gettysburg, at the battlefield.
Oh, my God.
They have renovated a theater for us.
Yeah.
We have a long-term deal, and the Civil War, in its original way we did it at the Alley Theater, which is what we should have done on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
in a concert form with the band on stage, that's going to be done there every summer from now on, from Memorial Day to Labor Day. And there'll probably be a television special with that, and I think the president might show up. It's going to be a really cool thing.
Man.
Because it is Gettysburg, because of where it is and what it's about. It's the perfect place for the show, and that has worked out. So we're very, very excited about that. That starts the summer of 2006. Also, in May of 2006, my show Vienna, which is based on Frederick Morton's book, A Nervous Splendor, and is about the star-crossed love story of Rudolf Habsburg and Mary Becerra. There's been a couple movies done, the famous one with Charles Boyer, the French one, and then Hollywood did a terrible version with James Mason, Omar Sharif, Catherine Deneuve, Ava Gardner, etc. We're going to do that. It opens in Budapest May 26 next year, and then goes there for a year, and then goes to Vienna. So that's opening next year. I have two projects in Japan next year.
Yeah.
I have a rock and roll version of Carmen that opens in Prague.
Yeah.
And we are in negotiations right now for Count of Monte Cristo, which is going to open in St. Gallen, Switzerland, where currently Dracula, in a totally different form than it was on Broadway, is a huge hit. You cannot get a ticket right now to Dracula in St. Gallen. So we're gonna have that there. And then I have an opening also at the Alley Theater next year of a new musical that Greg is directing that we'll talk about at another time.
Is that it? Gosh, you're getting kind of lazy. I know.
But the funny thing is, I know. Listen, I hear myself talking, and believe me, I think this is ridiculous. It's just that things come when they come, you know? You write these things, and sometimes they take years. They always take years,
yeah.
No matter how many. But sometimes things come together, and this is one of those times where so much has kind of come together between the recording and the actual openings of shows. And it's the next 2 years are just going to be nuts. Plus, you know, we just did Waiting for the Moon, the Scott and Zelda big band musical.
Yeah, that got some good reviews. Yeah,
it got some really good reviews. It got great buzz, and we are now raising money for that. Vincent Marini is a young kid down in Jersey who produced and directed it. and he did a great job, and we're excited about the prospects of that. That was with Lauren Kennedy and Jared Emick starring in that, and I think that's going to have a real life. And there's just all of these great things happening, plus the things that I'm really doing right now, meaning the next couple of months. And one is Jekyll and Hyde, believe it or not, another life. And the way this came
out... It's now a video game. No.
Well, you never know. We are working on the movie of Jekyll and Hyde. Leslie and I are in negotiations right now for the movie rights of the show. In fact, we're just about done with that, so that'll be an announcement in the weeks to come. But Jekyll and Hyde in concert, which is just three characters, Lucy, Emma, and Jekyll and Hyde. Actually, three and a half characters, or depends how you want to put it. And it's going to tour America and the world. And it's going to be done with 30-piece orchestras and full symphonic orchestras, like the Cincinnati Pops, the Atlanta Pops, you know, just two that I know are already booked. And Rob Evan is going to do Jekyll and Hyde, who played it, I think, I don't know how many billions of times on and off Broadway. And Kate Schindel, who played it Lucy on Broadway, who is Miss America, is going to do it. And Brandy Burkhart, who is Miss New York, who is a fantastic new singer, she's going to do Emma. And it's going to be the three of them, and actually we start in a couple of weeks in Birmingham, Alabama. And then in October, the tour starts in earnest, and there'll be dates all over the place. And I think it's going to be a great new business. And what's interesting about it is the concert version of the show. So you get all the hit songs, but Leslie reworked the script with Greg, so through diary entries, letters, etc., they actually tell you the story. So the audience not only gets the songs, but they really get kind of an inside personal version of it. And we've tried it out a few places. It's worked just fantastic. And so we're excited about that. And that's kind of, and then there's going to be the record of the concert version of Jekyll and Hyde, which we are in the studio doing right now. Because, hell, if we're going to have a tour out there around the world, we might as well have a record that goes with it.
Oh, man. Well, so that's amazing.
That's happening as we speak. I mean, that's when after this interview, I go back to the studio where I've been living.
Well, let me ask. We've talked so much about the professional. Let's very quickly sort of end our wonderful conversation with the personal. Now, you're currently... what is the status there? I mean, I think you and Linda Etter are no longer...
Yes, we've been separated for 2 years now, and
but still, still amicable.
We're terrific friends, and we are going to work together again. In case the fans I know are always worried about that, we're going to work together again, and you're going to hear about it very soon. What it is that we're doing, and our priority is Jake, who's 6 years old, and taking care of him and his life and what that's about. And we keep our private lives, really pretty private. And, suffice it to say, we're in great shape.
Yeah, but also, are you, dating, or are you back in that field, or do you even have time to meet people, or how's that all going?
Oh, let's say it's going very well.
Oh, mit Lazel. Good.
It's going very well. And then, the other thing, David, is, starting Labor Day, and for the next three Mondays, I'm actually going to be at Joe's Pub, doing the music of Frank Wildhorn, or Frank Wildhorn and Friends, whatever you want to call it.
So you're going to be at the piano, but it's not just you singing. You've got a couple of...
No, I don't sing. I'm going to be... I might, to give the audience some humor once in a while, I might say. I'm going to do three Mondays. I haven't done this in a long time. I've been so busy doing what I do, and I really wanted to go back and just be a musician and play the piano and do that. And some people, really got behind me and said, Frank, you should do this. You should tell stories of the songs and the shows, etc. So lo and behold, we're doing three Mondays at Joe's Pub starting Labor Day.
Labor Day.
And that's with four singers. It's with Michael Lanning, who's the heartbeat of America, if you listen to the Chevy commercials. But he was the Northern captain in Civil War. He's got a great rock voice. Rob Evan again. Kate Schindel is doing it. And Tracy Miller, who is right now Penny Pingleton in Hairspray.
Oh.
She's a friend of mine who was in Dracula and in Camille Claudel. And I love her, and she's a great pop R&B singer. And she's going to be doing it. So it'll be the four of them around the piano with me. And then the last week of September, we're going to take the show, add a band to it, and we're going to do it in Marlton, New Jersey, at the Lenape Performing Arts Center, which is where Waiting for the Moon just closed. And we're going to do it down there for a full weekend. And if it's fun and we like it, then we're going to roll it out and we'll go tour that next year, too.
Frank, First of all, I don't know how you find the time to do everything you do as well as you do it, but I'm very glad you found the time to talk with us here in the neighborhood. I wish you the best with all your projects, and just thanks, and keep doing what you do.
Well, David, I appreciate it, and I appreciate the time, and it's always communicating with the people what it's all about. We are in the communications business, aren't we?
Exactly. So, Frank Wildhorn, thanks again.
Thank you.